The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Now and then we go back into our Book Nook archive and pull out an interview that we recorded a number of years ago, and today is one of those days. Back in the year 2000, I interviewed Kinky Friedman. Over the 25 years that I've been interviewing authors on WYSO, you never can predict whether a guest will give a good interview, a bad interview, a boring interview, an exciting interview, and I certainly couldn't predict what was going to happen with Kinky Friedman. I had not listened to this interview since we originally had our conversation, and I had forgotten just how politically incorrect this man is. He still is. He's still around. He's probably best known as a musician. He's also a novelist. He lives in Texas, and he's a very peculiar fellow. He has not embraced any kind of political correctness over his career. He's gotten himself into a lot of controversies, and I'll tell you about some of those during the program. Kinky was born in Chicago, but as a very young child, he was moved with his family to a ranch in Kerrville, Texas. He had an early interest in both pop music and chess. At the age of 7, he was one of 50 local players to challenge the grandmaster chess player Samuel Reshevsky to simultaneous games in Houston. Reshevsky won all 50 games, but Friedman was by far his youngest competitor. He served 2 years in the U.S. Peace Corps, teaching in Borneo, and during his service he met his future road manager Dylan Ferrero, with whom he still works. Friedman lives at Echo Hill Ranch, his family's summer camp near Kerrville, Texas. He founded Utopia Animal Rescue Ranch, also located near Kerrville, whose mission is to care for stray, abused, and aging animals. More than 1,000 dogs have been saved by this organization from being euthanized. I call this the Best of the Book Nook, but I should probably call this interview the Worst of the Book Nook. It's a great interview, but Kinky says some somewhat interesting things as far as he skirts the edge. He doesn't use profanity, but he uses some language that might be offensive to somebody. He also says some things that might be offensive to somebody. So bear that in mind as we listen now to the Kinkster, Kinky Friedman. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I've been joined in studio by Kinky Friedman. Welcome.
Hey, great to be here, Vic.
It's a dream come true, Kinky.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be y'all.
Kinky, you've got a new book out. It's called The Mile High Club. You're also going to be playing a very rare concert in Ohio tonight at Canal Street Tavern. It's sort of a convergence of literature and music.
Yeah, I suppose so. It's a schizophrenic audience that we're drawing, particularly around the world. We just got back from Australia. When I say we, I mean myself and Little Juford. Little Juford is the last surviving member of the Texas Jew Boys who's still ambulatory. It was our band in the early 70s. And I thank the Lord we never had a big commercial hit, because we'd be playing Disneyland with the Pips right now, probably, if that had happened. But Australia was great, and Europe. I mean, these places were usually sold out, all the shows, because of the books. In America, we still get, I'd say, more than half the audience coming because of the books, and the other half are what I like to refer to as insects trapped in amber, who are the people that don't know about the books but are coming because of the music.
Well, amber's a beautiful thing.
It is, yes. There's a little bit of Judy Garland in me still. Yeah.
Kinky Friedman joins us. Kinky, I'm wondering, when did you decide to take that turn in the road that turned you into a novelist?
Well, looking back, I think probably being a country singer was a tragic mistake on my part. As a kid, I always wanted to be a country star. And if that's what you dream about as a kid, you usually wind up a best-selling novelist. That's a little trick God plays on us. But I'm still envious of people like Dwight Yoakam and Willie Nelson. I mean, I have tour bus envy, you know. But I must admit that being an author is a lot, it's a lot less painful, I think, than being a country singer on the road. Of course, you wind up being on the road anyway, doing book tours. I think the longevity of an author might be a lot longer. And particularly the way this career seems to be shaping itself is of mild interest to me, because I look at these space takers like Mary Higgins Clark and John Grisham and people like that.
Mary is sat right there where you're sitting.
That is just wonderful.
Is the seat still warm?
The seat's very cold, as a matter of fact. Now, I've met Mary in New York and found her a very charming lady. But
she is.
You just can't read her books at gunpoint. You cannot read them unless you're at gunpoint. I mean, it's just, and there's nothing wrong with this, but anybody that's that popular, or anybody they can't be great. I mean, as Voltaire said, the majority is always wrong. They just are. And lately I've been thinking of the people that inspire me. And, you know, what they had in common is they died in pauper's graves. I mean, Oscar Wilde and Van Gogh and Mozart and Jesus and Anne Frank are no grave at all, you know, in the latter two cases. And these people reach across time and geography, and they really inspire us. Now, Harold Robbins was probably the biggest literary phenomenon of the past century. And today, Charles Bukowski is zimming past him in book sales. I mean, when was the last time you saw anybody reading a Harold Robbins novel? You don't, because...
I think it was me.
It was you last week, but...
No, it wasn't last week. It was The Carpetbaggers, and I think it was when I was in high school.
So
it was a hot book.
Yeah, yeah. Then it was a hot book. But then we discard these people like hula hoops, and frankly, books written by living people are rarely very good. I mean, I'm totally Dead Poets Society. You read a book by a dead guy, it's going to be good.
Well, I actually enjoyed Bukowski while he was still alive, and it was a miracle he lived that long.
Yeah, it truly was. He's one of my heroes, and I like people that passionately interweave their life and their work. People like Hank Williams or Allen Ginsberg, Graham Parsons. Charles Bukowski's a good one. Willie Nelson's a good one. As opposed to people like Alice Cooper, who dress up bizarrely and do a weird performance at night, and then in the afternoon they play golf with the record executives.
Mm.
So there's a lot of... you don't seem to get very much of... I mean, I read The Street Lawyer by John Grisham. And it's a mediocre book. It's okay. But there's just... If the man has any soul, there's none of it put in that book. And... really, I guess what it says is more about us than about them. I mean, we deserve, you know, every culture gets what it deserves, and we deserve Rush Limbaugh and Dr. Laura. That's what our culture deserves.
Well, fortunately for our listeners, neither of those people appears on this radio station. Instead, we've got people like you, Kinky.
Well, there's always I like to be kind of a jet set gypsy, you know, kind of a cult... cult figure internationally, you know, and it's a little bothersome that I'm doing so well in certain places like Germany. The books are bestsellers, and we did a tour, Little Juford and I, last fall, and of Europe. We played 42 cities, and we played Brussels, where I formerly worked as NATO commander, and we did 12 shows in Germany. And you may know the Germans are my second favorite people, and my first is everybody else. Lord have mercy. But in Germany, we had a couple of incidents that were interesting, I thought. One was in Nuremberg, of all places, and the audiences were terrific.
Uh-huh.
And the books are just flying out of there. They're just in German. And the young people tell me they're buying the books in German and English to learn English.
Oh, my.
Which is kind of alarming when you think about it. But there was a guy that came up to me, a young guy, and he says, "Would you sign this book?" He had God Bless John Wayne in German. "Would you sign this for my kid?" And I said, "Sure. How old's your kid?" He said, "He's 1 year old. But as soon as he's able to read, this is the first book I'm going to give him." Now, that's very nice. It's hard to hate people like that. And And in Cologne, Germany, there was a blind woman that came to the show from Paris with her seeing eye dog. And we brought her up on stage to sing the song Old Ship with the dog, which was a very poignant moment for us all. And afterwards, she invited us to Paris, and we had a day off, so I asked the German promoter how far it was from Cologne to Paris. And he said, oh, it's about a four-day march. So that was the European tour. Now, Jufert has taped these shows, and that's available on a CD.
Classic Snatches.
Classic Snatches from Europe on Sphincter Records. That's right. Little Jufert is the president and CEO of the record company.
I bet you've got a website. I bet you're upscale.
Yeah, he's got sphinctorrecords.com, I think. And I think his slogan is leaving our competitors behind. But it's a sick thing. I mean, we'll probably have some of those around tonight, too. The first five books that I wrote, which have been out of print for about 197 years, have just been reissued by Van Damme Press. And they should be in all the stores, but if you want to get them sooner, you can check kinkyfriedman.com.
Uh-huh.
And as long as we're dot-comming, which I don't touch the internet. I think it's the work of Satan, personally. And it sucks away your soul every time you use it. But it is a way people can find stuff. And one of the things I would like to mention is utopiarescue.com, which is our rescue ranch for dogs and other animals in Utopia, Texas. And anybody that's an animal lover should check that out, utopiarescue.com. That's been great work for the past 2.5 years, and it's something I've never really done before, working with abused animals and strays and animals from the pound. And it's made me, you know, as I've mentioned before, I'd probably be a Buddhist today if it weren't for Richard Gere. One man.
I've heard Republicans call Al Gore Satan, you know, the inventor of the internet, but I didn't expect that from you, Kinky.
Well, I like to stay away from politics. I just had one run at politics that was in, I don't know if you're familiar with this, 1986, when I ran for justice of the peace in my hometown of Kerrville, Texas, and my fellow Kerrverts returned me to the private sector. And I believe I had a memorable campaign slogan then, which was, if you elect me the first Jewish justice of the peace, I'll reduce the speed limits to 54.95. But politics loss has been literature's gain. Yes.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, your home for independent news and hand-picked music. And it's the best of the book, Nook, or the worst of the book, Nook. Take your pick with Kinky Friedman, recorded back in 2000. We'll continue my interview with the Kinkster right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO. Back in the year 2000, I interviewed Kinky Friedman. He's a dual threat. He's a musician and an author. And at the time, he had a novel out called The Mile High Club. And let me set the scene for you a little bit. Kinky was on book tour. He was coming through Dayton, and he was going to have two appearances in Dayton that evening. The first one was going to be at the beloved Books & Company bookstore. I know many of you remember when they were located over in Kettering at the Town & Country Shopping Center. It was a mecca there for writers. They used to have writers come in there almost every day on book tour, sometimes a couple of writers. They'd have a noon event, and they'd have an evening event. And another mecca, long remembered, long cherished, and now gone, the Canal Street Tavern, was a great music mecca. And Kinky, after he did his book date, was going to have a music date that evening at Canal Street Tavern. And the opening act was going to be Mojo Nixon. What a show that must have been. Let's listen now to Kinky. The Mile High Club.
I think Mojo Nixon is going to join us from Cincinnati, too, tonight.
For real?
Yeah. So we talked to him this morning, and he asked me if I was a member of the Mile High Club, and I said, no, I wasn't. And I said, are you a member? And he said, yes, solo. Pretty good.
That Mojo is quick.
Yes, it's pretty fast. One. Well, you know, Bill Clinton's a member, and Willie Nelson's a member. I mean, I'd like to be a member of the club. It just hasn't worked out for me. Are you a member, Vic?
I think somewhere we're all members
yes.
of something, and we're members, yeah.
Spiritually speaking.
Spiritually. I really enjoyed this book, Kinky. As Eileen, our news director, mentioned to you before you came in, I reviewed it. I do a book review program here as well, and I gave it a really good review, and I just warned readers. I said, you know, the wit is flying, and it's scattered all over the carpet, and you just got to be careful where you step.
Yes, it's a bit different from my other work. It's a bit of a departure in that this book has a plot, at least a little bit of a plot, and a surprise ending.
It certainly was a surprise.
Well, I mean, if a shrink got hold of the book, you know, and I mean, I am exploring my sexuality, but this is ridiculous. I mean, I'm almost out of control writing these. This was fun, though. I enjoyed it very much, and I mean, that's important because I suspect I'd write probably, you know, I write if I had an audience, it would be, aside from all the little Emily Dickinsons out there, you know, which I love, would be for a dead cat, you know, or a dead sweetheart or a dead mother, you know, all of which I have. So I kind of commune with them. I think that's who I'm really, that audience is what I'm aiming for.
Well, the ending definitely came as a shock to me. It was gratuitous sex, I would say.
You know, I've never been able to really write a sex scene. I mean, there's some writers that can do it, some that can't. I just can't do it. So, I mean, I have to stick with what I do. What I can do is write humorous books, and right now there's a dearth of that in this country. In fact, there's only two novelists that I can think of that are very funny, and that's me and Carl Hiaasen, and sometimes I'm not so sure about Carl.
Well, we're dearth poor, as they say.
Yes.
Yes.
And the ones that were funny are just not, you know, they've lost it. I mean, unless you think, you know, Dave Barry's funny. I mean, I guess he's funny.
He sat right there, too, and he's a goofball.
Dave Barry's a funny guy. Now, he's not really a novelist. I guess we can't call him that. He's mostly a newspaper column guy.
Well, what you see is what you get. And when he was there sitting where you're sitting, he had his laptop computer, which he pulled out, which he could take your name, like he could take Kinky Friedman. He had some kind of program in his computer where he could make obscene anagrams out of your name. It was kind of cute.
God, I was just thinking, there still is something to writing a book that's very nice. I thought you were going to say that he was working while he was doing his interview, which, like William Buckley, you know, will write a spy novel in 48 hours at the airport, you know. But it sucks. I mean, basically, you keep seeing his leering face at every page you're turning. It's, you know, as Raymond Chandler said, the business of fiction is to recreate the illusion of life.
Uh-huh.
So you got a guy like Dick Francis, who is not the kind of lyrical writer that the Kinkster might be. He's more of a flat prose writer. But as you're reading Dick Francis, you forget that you're reading a book. And that's, he's got the magic. And William Buckley doesn't. And there's a lot of, well, Hunter Thompson doesn't when he writes a novel. You know, like that novel of his that came out was just, you know, didn't hold up, wasn't readable.
Well,
when he covers an event, you know, that's a different matter.
Yeah, then he's a gonzo journalist.
Right.
And that reminds me, Tom Robbins was here recently. And
how's Tom Robbins? I was a pen pal of his briefly.
He's a sweet guy. Mm-hmm. He really is. And he came in with this guy who he identified as his
is he gay?
Lawyer.
He's gay? No.
I have no idea. But,
yeah.
But he says he loves women, so hard to say. But he came in with this guy who he identified as his lawyer, so I immediately got that, you know, fear and loathing in Las Vegas thing going. You know, it was like the Hunter Thompson. I said, are you a gonzo journalist? And he started laughing because he realized that this was not an original
right.
thing. But he's a wonderful guy. He showed up a half hour late for the interview, and I didn't even care.
Kind of Marilyn Monroe-like. There.
Yeah, just an amazing guy. Kinky, when you write a book
being Jewish, I'm very punctual, you know, and that's about it.
I'm glad you are.
Get here, I'll put the whole audience into a coma, but the point is...
When I read The Mile High Club, I kept saying to myself, this kinky guy in the book, is this the same kinky guy who is writing the book?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so. I think I was thinking about that, and at the same time Alice Cooper was playing golf with the record executives in Hollywood, Tom Waits and I were both wearing our sunglasses 24 hours a day. I mean, we were totally into whatever we were all the time. Which, again, made it hard to tell what we were doing from who we were. You take a guy like Allen Ginsberg, if you look at the body of his work, you probably won't find that many great poems. You'll find a few that everybody recognizes as great. And then there's a lot of these shouting rants that he does, you know, that are... But the spirit of Allen Ginsberg, the way he lived his life and his work combined, makes him an icon all over the world. I don't know about this country. This country, you know, we're busy with Tom Clancy or somebody else. It's amazing. They told me recently that the British publish more titles than we do every year. We publish many more books, but they're all by the same seven people, or whatever they're all. And, God, I don't know. It's... It gets a, I mean, I think things are going very well. I think I'm killing a lot of trees, but, and I think the Americans will catch on.
I love your sidekicks in this book.
They're all real people. Yeah,
Rambam and Ratso?
Yeah, and McGovern and Stephanie DuPont. They're, McGovern has written a cookbook that Simon & Schuster put out last year called Eat, Drink, and Be Kinky. And this is... He is going to go to Europe with us in November. We're touring with him and Ratso and Little Jeuford and me. A book and concert tour of England, Ireland, Scotland. And there the books are very big. And to meet, I've already discovered this. When we took McGovern to Australia, it was amazing. I mean, he's a guy who once, he's a reporter. He was for 28 years for the Daily News in New York. And he covered Charles. He was the first guy that got Charles Manson jailhouse interview and so forth.
Oh, wow.
And he once combed his hair before meeting a racehorse. You know, he was a very charming guy. But in Australia, these people had read all the books and read about him. And then to meet him was like meeting a fictional character that just stepped out of Disneyland. Everybody there wanted his picture taken with him. And half of them thought I got him pretty good. Half of them thought I didn't represent him, you know, whatever, but... Wasn't exactly what they thought, or he was precisely what they expected. But they were totally enamored of McGovern, so we'll see what happens with this European thing. Mojo and I, we had a screenplay called Two Schmucks from Texas that was pretty funny about these two guys that tried to make it, and they just irritated everybody on the planet. I don't know. It's just, yeah, he's a very clever guy, very fast.
Well, he's an acquired taste, I found.
Yes, he is.
I've heard many tales of people taking someone to see a Mojo concert that wasn't familiar with Mojo. You know, a hardcore Mojo fan with, say, their spouse. And the reactions are pretty amazing.
Well, some of his titles are wonderful. You know, Bring Me the Head of David Geffen. You know, I mean, some of these are just brilliant. And last time he had on the back of his guitar, last time I saw him was... about 6-7 years ago in Texas, he'd spun his guitar around like Ernest Tubb used to do. And Ernest Tubb's guitar, he'd say, thanks. Mojo said, Dean Martin is God. That was, I think, right after Dean was bugled to Jesus.
Kinky, you've had a very interesting life so far. I'm guessing, I'm imagining this, and I'm wondering...
I'll probably go back to my hotel room and hang myself.
Perfect. Perfect.
But it's too late to have a perfectly timed country music death, Vic. That's the problem.
At least get through your engagements and Dayton. Go to New York and do it. You've had so many wonderful experiences in New York. Isn't that a better place?
Here's something that not many of the listeners will probably understand this little joke, but I told my sister that I have this gig. I've got this gig I'm doing up in Dayton, Ohio. And she said, well, it's better than doing a gig in Canton, Ohio. You understand that, right?
Yeah.
You understand the Hank Williams reference?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. that's a good line, actually. Really. Said,
well, that's a really good one, yeah.
Better than going to do a gig in Canton, Ohio. Yeah.
Now, when you were born and your parents decided to name you Kinky, what was that about?
Well, it's not. Kinky is obviously, my full Christian name is Richard Kinky Big Dick Friedman, but Kinky is, when you're named Kinky Friedman, you have to be famous. I mean, if you're not famous, it is a social embarrassment, and people say, what was that, you know? And now I'm kind of at the point where, since I'm smoking cigars all the time, about half the people that confront me at places are fans, and the other half are people who want me to put out the cigar. and you can't tell which. And in fact, that's, I think, one of the things that is really wrong. We have a great country. But traveling in Europe and doing these other shows around the world, I'm almost never misunderstood. They know where I'm coming from. If I'm doing something irreverent, they know that I know that Jesus is a good sport.
Uh-huh.
And that he has a sense of humor. And the other things, whatever, if there's a song that knocks a certain race or religion, they don't misunderstand it. Or the Americans still, you'll find somebody who will think I'm bashing gays or I'm anti whatever the hell it is. Or you'll find a straight Jew, that finds me offensive, Of course, Imus was playing They Ain't Making Jews Like Jesus Anymore as the Gore Lieberman theme song the other day, which is okay.
Didn't she used to run around with the Yippies?
Well, I was a little I wasn't really involved in that. I missed the whole psychedelic deal. I was in the Peace Corps in Borneo.
Oh, okay.
In the 60s, where I was an agricultural extension worker, and my job was to help people who'd been farming successfully for over 2,000 years to improve their agricultural methods. While I was over there, I missed most of that. But later, I became friends with Abbie Hoffman, and I met Abbie just as he was going underground.
Oh.
We both knew of each other, probably through Ratzo.
Uh-huh.
And Ratzo was Bukowski's friend, too. So Abbie called me and invited me to come to his farewell party and to play Ride 'Em Jew Boy, this song of mine about the Holocaust. And that's the one Willie Nelson recorded in this tribute album to myself, Pearls in the Snow. So I did the song. Anyway, it was a doubleheader. It was a co-bill. It was me, and it was Abbie's. It was a video of Abbie's vasectomy. That was what the whole show was, apparently. And he had about 1,000 people there at the time. And the next day, he disappeared. But stayed in touch with me, and I'm sure with a network of people.
He was in Canada, wasn't he?
He was in Canada for a while, and he stayed down in our ranch in Texas for about 6 months when he was running from the feds.
So you were harboring a criminal?
Well, this came out when I was running for Justice of the Peace in Kerrville in 1986, that the UPI had a story that this candidate for this office in a small Texas town had harbored this fugitive from the government, Abbie Hoffman, and which didn't do my campaign hell of a lot of good. I mean, I was already not in very good shape politically there in Kerrville. Ironically, it was something at the time I wanted to do. I was kind of serious about doing something on a local level, But Abbie was a great American in a lot of ways and a tragic guy in that he really stayed true to his school when all the others seemed to sell out. He never did.
Didn't he ultimately, wasn't he running because of that Peruvian marching powder thing?
Yes, and again, this is Abbie never, he was never a big doper.
Uh-huh.
And he certainly could never have sold dope. I mean, he yapped to everybody. He had the biggest mouth in the world. He couldn't keep a secret. He never wanted money. He never could have hoarded any or kept cocaine or something like that. He wasn't even really into cocaine. I mean, I don't think he was into it at all. No, mm-hmm. I was into it. Mm-hmm. I mean, very heavily in the late 70s and the 80s. Did just enough Peruvian marching powder to decorate a large nativity scene. and it wasn't good for the Kingster, but I've always felt you got to find what you like and let it kill you.
Yeah. A lot of people did choose to do that with the marching powder.
Yeah, the marching powder did me no good. I'm just amazed at this career here, frankly. I mean, when I look how far back that was. I mean, my contemporaries were like Country Joe and the Fish and Commander Cody.
Uh-huh.
And Norman Greenbaum, Spirit in the Sky, people like that.
Sure.
And that's a long time ago. And as F. Scott Fitzgerald says, there's no second acts in America, And so to have these books come out of nowhere, and they're catching on in this country. I mean, but they're really doing well. And they just went into the Love Song of J. Edgar Hoover, went into Japanese and Hebrew, I think, last month. So there's progress around the world. It's just, it's America that is a little slow out of the chute, to borrow a rodeo term.
That's okay with you, isn't it?
Sure, it's fine, because I don't want to be too successful in my own lifetime, and I don't want to be too happy. That is a kiss of death for immortality. I mean, that's an indication that you're not going to mean much in the future, probably. It's very unlikely that people in the future will be reading John Grisham or will be listening to Garth Brooks. More likely, they'll be listening to Townes Van Zandt or someone like that over Garth Brooks. And there's this great aching chasm in our society, in our culture, that requires somebody like Garth Brooks to come along, or Stephen King, or whoever can sell a lot of books. And there has to be more to life than doing that. There just has to be, more than trying to be on the New York Times bestseller list. And I have to stop trashing that, because I suspect I'll probably be there in the next couple of years.
Holy smokes.
And that would be my creative death, you know. Hemingway, I read The Old Man and the Sea. I mean, I'm sure I read it in high school and repressed it or something, you know. But I read it again in Europe this year. And it's really a great book. And he wrote it, then I read his biography, and he wrote it with this dog called Black Dog.
Uh-huh.
Do you know about this dog?
No.
He had an old dog that was so old that it could hardly hear or see, you know, but he'd had it forever down in Cuba. And as he was writing The Old Man and the Sea, this dog would stay awake every night with Ernest. And he felt his job was to stay up as long as Ernest did. So Ernest would stay up to like 5 in the morning writing, and then both of them would crash. He and Black Dog would crash together. And he finished The Old Man and the Sea that way. And it was after he finished that, and when he was gone from Cuba for a while, or briefly, that I think it was Batista's goon squad came by the house to check for weapons. And the dog tried to protect the house, and the dog could hardly walk, you know.
Just, uh-huh.
And so one of the soldiers clubbed the dog to death with a rifle. And that death of Black Dog, although the biographer didn't draw this inference, but I did, was the end of Hemingway's creative life. I mean, after that book, I think that was it. I mean, he wrote more, but of course, winning the Nobel Prize for Literature never helps. I mean, no one has ever written anything good after winning that, apparently.
That'll wipe out the spark, for sure.
Yeah, totally, whatever spark there was.
Hmm.
But I think animals have a... Now, I write with animals around me.
Mm-hmm. I keep running into cats that are very dog-like. I have a cat at home who waits for me to come home and follows me around. And literally, if I go upstairs, the cat will follow me, just like a dog. And I love that cat so much.
How long have you had it?
About 5 years.
The death of my cat, Cuddles, which was, I wrote an epilogue at the end of Elvis, Jesus, and Coca-Cola. Have you read that?
No, I haven't.
Well, check out the epilogue at the end about how, of course, I guess an epilogue always is at the end. But this has been a piece. I've got more mail from, mostly from men, interestingly enough, but who are broken up about death of pets, you know. It's basically just a little story about how when you die, all the dogs and cats you've ever had in your life will come running to meet you, you know,
aww,
to heaven. And a little bit about Cuddle's death and life. And it's, we were talking earlier about how people that don't like cats, this must be very irritating, these cat books. And there are some cat books that are bad, like that one that is The Cat Who Killed Christ, The Cat Who Did This. You know that woman? Or
The cat
who did this, The Cat Who Did... Well, those aren't... I don't think those are really good. And I try to use the cat. I think the cat is more of a conscience than anything else in these books. But I've become very close to my cats. There's another cat that was bugled to Jesus about a week ago.
Oh.
Of mine, who was 22 years old, Dr. Scat. And Dr. Scat was just, my brother, my teacher, my lover, my friend.
Hmm.
Well, I don't know about all that, but he was...
Yeah, forget the friend part.
He was, Dr. Scat and I were very, very close. And when he died, I went to the True Value Hardware store in Kerrville to get a sharpshooter shovel to bury Dr. Scat. And salesman there didn't know, of course, that I was going to bury the cat or anything had happened. And he said, good luck with your project. So these days when people are getting married or whatever they're doing, I always tell them, good luck with your project.
Seems appropriate. You are listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Going back to the year 2000 for my interview with Kinky Friedman. He had a novel out called The Mile High Club. He was also on tour with his musical group. And this is the only interview I ever did with Kinky Friedman, and we'll bring you more of it right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO, my 2000 interview with Kinky Friedman, talking about his novel, The Mile High Club, also talking about his musical career. His first band was formed when he was going to the University of Texas. It was called King Arthur and the Carrots. That band poked fun at surf music, and they released one single in 1966 called Schwinn 24, backed by Beach Party Boo Boo. In 1973, Kinky formed his second band, Kinky Friedman and the Texas Jew Boys, which many took to be a play on the name of the famous band Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys. In keeping with the band's satirical nature, each member had a comical name, such as the aforementioned Little Juford, who was with him on this particular tour. Also, they toured in what they called a tour bus. It was a Cadillac with 10-year-old expired license plates and a propensity to break down. But according to Friedman, her talent lay in her ability to stop on a dime and pick up the change. Friedman's father objected to the name of the band, calling it, quote, negative, hostile, peculiar, which gave Kinky even more reason to choose the name. Arriving on the wave of country rock following on from Gram Parsons, the band, the Eagles, Friedman originally found cult fame as a country western singer. His break came in 1973 thanks to Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen, who contacted Vanguard Music on his behalf. Friedman released Kinky Friedman in 1974 for ABC Records, then toured with Bob Dylan in 1975 and 1976. His repertoire mixed social commentary, songs like We Reserve the Right to Refuse Service to You, maudlin ballads like Western Union Wire, and his song Ride 'em Jew Boy, which was an extended tribute to the victims of the Holocaust. Now, Kinky get away with all this because he's Jewish. Some of his most famous songs are They Ain't Making Jews Like Jesus Anymore, a song in which Kinky verbally and physically beats up a drunken white racist who berates blacks, Jews, Italians, Greeks, and Sigma Nus in a bar with lyrics such as, Oh, they ain't making Jews like Jesus anymore. They ain't making carpenters that know what nails are for. Let's continue now with Kinky Friedman.
We've had a listener call in who apparently wants to get to the bottom of a burning question.
Well, he's probably clinically insane because most people that call radio stations are, right?
Well, you know, we can always hope. This listener wants to know why you named your record label what you named it.
Sphincter Records?
Yeah.
I had nothing to do with that label. That's okay. Little Juford's record company. And Little Juford lately is going around announcing that that he is the Lindbergh baby. And I mean, he's a true idiot savant. And, you know, you got to see the guy to believe him. So he's very entertaining and very humorous. But he named the company. He runs the company. Just good little Jewish businessman, you know.
How did you meet Little Juford?
I met him on a gangplank of Noah's Ark. I met him when we were 7 years old. Yeah. And a long time before the Jew Boys got going.
So where are you from originally?
I don't like to tell people this.
Okay.
Texans this, but we're not in Texas. And I was born in Chicago in the same hospital as Shel Silverstein, Michael Reese Hospital.
South Sider?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, I lived there a year. Uh-huh. Didn't like it. Moved to Texas. And it's ironic that I was not born in Texas, and that Texans, I think they've now come to accept me, but they used to think I was a Yankee because I speak well and I went to college and all this sort of thing. And
uh-huh.
In fact, I was a Plan 2 graduate from the University of Texas in Austin, and Plan 2 is a very highly advanced liberal arts program, mainly distinguished by the fact that every student has some form or other of facial tic. And
excuse me, I'm not used to laughing this much during my interviews, so I apologize.
I'll have to bring a Mary Higgins Clark. Now, I'll tell you the truth, Mary Higgins Clark I found her to be a charming person who's actually led a very interesting life, where she raised five kids. She was, you know, in total poverty, and she was a colorful person. I mean, which raises the question, you know, when you write a book, you kind of unmask yourself. I mean, if it's you can have a, you can be a fabulously interesting person, but if you know, the book could just be a little ho hum. And an example of this is, of course, is Georges Simenon, who is a hero of mine. He was one of the most amoral men who ever lived. And, you know, I mean, he was, oh, man, terribly sexually. I mean, you know, screwing his maid every time, three marriages. And like, and he married the maid, then he screwed the next maid, and then he married. And then when he was with the Nazis, he was a Nazi. When he was with the underground, he was, I mean, he was just a, you know, very amoral person.
But a great writer.
He was a great writer. Uh-huh. And the character he created, Inspector McGray, was amazing. Uh-huh. I mean, is a character that walks around the streets of Paris, this police chief, with his hands in his pockets and his raincoat, you know, smoking his pipe upside down in the rain, you know, looking at us. I mean, an observer of human nature, a mender of destinies. And the rest of us, you know, trying to wade through this interview with me. I'm trying to do this interview with you. Somebody's trying to ask a question. But McGray sees all this. I mean, he's really watching what all of us are doing. A very moral person.
Well, actually, the greatest pleasure that I have doing this program is having people like you on the program. And occasionally, I have a guest on who I have on more as a public service. I had Ted Nugent on recently, and I consider that to be just a public service, just to let people know this guy's out there. And,
well, there's nothing stupider than this bow hunting crap. Nothing stupider than that, okay? Because you got a guy, maybe Ted Nugent is a sharpshooter with a bow, but there's 97 other complete morons out there. Who are just, you know, who are the animals are just dying out and they run off and they die slowly in the woods. That's all. And if that's a sport, then that's a sport.
My guess is Kinky Friedman.
I wish Ted Nugent would have a hunting accident, really. You know, I celebrate hunting accidents. And I'd like him to have one.
I have no comment on that whatsoever.
Did you have any rapport with Ted in this? I mean, well, I'm sure he's not an all bad guy. In fact, there's aspects of him that I probably would like and relate to, but.
He's got a new book out. It's called God, Guns, and Rock and Roll. And the interview started badly because I asked him, and I ask people that are celebrities that aren't associated with being authors, I frequently ask them, and they never take offense, if they had a ghostwriter for the book. And they're always very willing to say, oh, yeah, I had this really great writer help me out. You know, Buzz Aldrin has a great guy help him out. They all have great people who help them. So I asked him that, and He got very, very angry, and we went downhill from there. I've had a number of people comment on the interview, probably 50 or 60 people. It was only last week, and the thing that comes to mind most often, at least 10 people have said, it was like watching a car wreck. You want to look away, but you just can't. You have to watch it, and it was...
Someone told me that knows about this, that John Denver was like that with interviews, that he was very... You know, he just went with his book interviews. When he did his interviews for his book, he just lost it. Burt Reynolds had trouble on book tours. A lot of these guys live in their limousines where they're just not used to somebody asking a real question or meeting people, you know, that might make a comment about something.
Kinky, I know from reading the book that you occasionally will toss in a little aside that is clearly a rock and roll memory. And I know you have some of those that are truly twisted and bizarre in the view of my listeners. And I was wondering if you could extract or excavate some of those just for fun. Is that too much?
Well, the only problem I have is that I've forgotten the first half of my life. I mean, you know, if people are constantly telling me these stories that I was involved with, and I'm sure they're true. And when they tell, I kind of vaguely remember it.
You talk about these hotels in New York and the last time you were there kind of thing.
Right. But the truth is, on the Bob Dylan tour in 76, I was really flying on 11 different kinds of herbs and spices. And as I like to say, most of the tour I was so high I needed a stepladder to scratch my ass, you know.
Was that Rolling Thunder?
That was Rolling Thunder. Okay. And the point is, if there's 50,000 people in the audience, you're a star just by getting on the stage. That's the easiest crowd in the world to work. And I think Joan Baez was terrific. And then she would take a little bit of Gorilla Biscuit, too, you know, a little Quaalude or something, you know. And everybody did some kind of drugs. And it was later when after that tour was over, when I had to do shows myself, that you find, you know, like Robert Frost says, hell is a half-filled auditorium. You know, that is tough to play. But the Bob Dylan tour was really smooth. And I find in general, well, yeah, there are stories, but they're not. There's a guy that at the Troubadour. This is not going to be a very good story, so I'll try to bring it in and in about 20 seconds.
Okay.
There's this guy hanging around me one night in the 70s at the Troubadour in Los Angeles, this club. And I was hanging out with, I don't know who I was hanging out. I know who I was hanging out with, Joni Mitchell at that time. Just, she was there and some friends. And this guy had kind of this cowboy hat. And he and I were the only two guys wearing cowboy hats. He had kind of some kind of straw cowboy hat. And I knew he was one of these singers from Texas, Rusty Weir, Ray Wiley Hubbard, one of these. I didn't know which one. And he kept saying, hey, Kink, let's do Kinkster, hey, you know. And I'd been with him the whole damn night drinking with him, and I just didn't want to ask him what his name was. You know, I was too, because I just wasn't sure. And I was, so the end of the evening, I'm just getting irritated, you know, and I finally say, look, pal, I've got to ask you something. What is your name? And he says, Eric Clapton. That was a good one. That was a big one.
Yeah. It wasn't a bad story.
No, and later Eric played on one of my albums, a couple of them, in fact. But he played on one. He played that song I wrote when I was 11 years old. Old Ben Lucas had a lot of mucus coming in. He played Sly Dobro in that. And an interesting thing, he was so gracious to everybody. I mean, you could bring in your cousin, your friend, anybody, except when I tried to introduce him to the producer, the record company guy. He would not shake hands with the guy. He said, piss off, mate. And, you know. And,
oh, wow.
Which, even then, he had the right idea.
That says something for him, doesn't it?
Oh, totally.
It?
Yeah. I was very impressed with that.
That's a great story.
Well, okay. You dredged one up there.
I love that. Thanks, Kinky.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for coming out and seeing us.
Vic, a pleasure. It's great being here. And I just want to remind the folks, if you're driving, folks, don't forget your car. Lord have mercy.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. That was Kinky Friedman, my only interview with him, recorded back in the year 2000. And back in those days when we had so many guests coming through the studio, occasionally someone would show up wearing a hat. I had two guests appear wearing cowboy hats. One of them was Baxter Black, no big surprise. But then Kinky Friedman showed up, and not only did he have a cowboy hat and all kinds of Western regalia on, he had a big, fat, unsmoked cigar that he twiddled during the entire interview. And what an interesting guy. You're probably wondering what he's up to these days. Well, he's still putting out music and books. In fact, he's got a new CD coming out next month, and he's going on tour for it. Kinky Hits the Road to promote his CD, Resurrection. He's calling it the Merry Kinkster Tour. And Kinky smokes Monte Cristo No. 2 cigars, the same brand smoked by Fidel Castro. However, he also smokes Bolivars, noting that Simon Bolivar is the only person in history to be exiled from a country named after him. Friedman makes his own cigars now under the name Kinky Friedman Cigars. He is a personal friend of Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. He visited both of them when they were in the White House. He wrote about his friendships with him in a column for the Texas Monthly. He's also responsible for the quote, "You've got to find what you love and let it kill you," which is often falsely attributed to the poet and novelist Charles Bukowski, who was an idol of Kinky's. He's had some notorious concerts. One of them was in Buffalo, New York, where he offended some women in the audience, and there was a fight, and they had to leave the stage. Another one was a recording for PBS's Austin City Limits, in which apparently he got so raunchy that the program was never, ever aired. The only time they recorded an Austin City Limits that did not get broadcast. He's still around. He's still doing it. He's in his mid-70s. He's still rescuing dogs down at his ranch in Texas, and I'm sure he's still got a potty mouth. What an experience that was. Be sure to tune in for the Book Nook tomorrow when my guest will be Mark Hamer. I'll be talking to him about his book, How to Catch a Mole, my favorite memoir of the year 2019. That's the Book Nook tomorrow morning at 10:30.